try to tell me you can't see it either, because I know you can. Just look.
I'm sorry, Dolores, she says.
She started to blubber, but I saw that mean little light dancing way down in her eyes. I saw it the way you can sometimes see fish in clear water when you get up on your knees in a boat and look over the side.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to make a mess. I was just trying to help.
That's what she always said when she shit the bed and then squooshed around in a little. Although that day was the first time she ever decided to finger paint with it as well.
I was just trying to help, Dolores.
Jesus wept. Sit there and shut up, I said. If you really don't want a fast ride over to that window and an even faster one down to the rock garden, you best mind what I say. And those girls down there at the foot of the stairs, I have no doubt at all, was listening to every word we were saying. But right then, I was too goddamn mad to think about anything like that. She had enough sense to shut up like I told her. But she looked satisfied, and why not? She'd done what she set out to do. This time it was her who'd won the battle and made it clear as window glass that the war wasn't over, not by a long chalk. I went to work cleaning and setting the place to rights again. It took the best part of 2 hours, and by the time I was done, my back was singing Ave Maria. I told you about the sheets, how that was, and I could see by your faces that you understood. It's harder to understand about her messes. I mean, shit don't cross my eyes. I've been wiping it up all my life, and the sight of it never crossed my eyes. It don't smell like a flower garden, of course, and you have to be careful of it because it carries disease, just like snot and spit and spilled blood, but it washes off, you know. Anyone who's ever had a baby knows that shit washes off. So that wasn't what made it so bad. I think it was that she was so mean about it, so sly about it. She bided her time, and when she got a chance, she made the worst mess she could, and she did it just as fast as she could, because she knew I wouldn't give her much time. She did that nasty thing on purpose. You see what I'm getting at? As far as her fogged-in brain would let her, she planned it out. And that weighed on my heart and darkened my outlook while I was cleaning up after her, while I was stripping the bed, while I was taking the shitty mattress pad and the shitty sheets and the shitty pillow slips down to the laundry chute, while I was scrubbing the floor and the walls and the window panes, while I was taking down the curtains and putting up fresh ones, while I was making her bed again, while I was gritting my teeth and trying to keep my back locked in place, while I cleaned her up and got a fresh nightgown on her and then hossed her out of the chair and back into bed again, and her not helping a bit, but just lolling there in my arms, dead weight, although I know damn well that was one of the days when she could have helped, if she'd wanted to. While I was washing the floor, while I was washing off her goddamn wheelchair, and really having to scrub by then because the stuff was dried on, while I was doing all that, my heart was low and my outlook was darkened. She knew it, too. She knew it, and it made her happy. When I went home that night, I took some Anacin 3 for my aching back, and then I went to bed and I curled up in a little ball, even though that hurt my back too, and I cried and cried and cried. Seemed like I couldn't stop. Never, at least since the old business of Joe, have I felt so downhearted and hopeless, or so friggin' old. That was the second way she had of being a bitch, by being mean. What say, Frank? Did she do it again? You damn tooting. She did it again the next week, and the week after that. It wasn't as bad as that first adventure either time, partly because she wasn't able to save up such a dividend, but mostly because I was prepared for it. I went to bed crying again after the second time it happened, though. And as I lay there in bed, feeling that misery way down low in my back, I made up my mind to quit. I didn't know what had happened to her, or who would take care of her. But right then, I didn't care a fiddly fuck, As far as I was concerned, she could starve to death, laying in her own shitty bed. I was still crying when I fell off to sleep, because the idea of quitting, of her getting the best of me, made me feel worse than ever. But when I woke up, I felt good. I guess it's true how a person's mind doesn't go to sleep, even if a person thinks it does. It just goes on thinking, and sometimes it does an even better job when the person in charge isn't there to frig it up with the usual run of chatter that goes on in a body's head. Chores to do, what to have for lunch, what to watch on TV, things like that. It must be true, because the reason I felt so good was that I woke up knowing how she was fooling me. The only reason I hadn't seen it before was because I was apt to underestimate her. Yeah, even me. And I knew how sly she could be from time to time. And once I understood the trick, I knew what to do about it. It hurt me to know I'd have to trust one of the Thursday girls to vacuum the Oberson. And the idea of Shauna Wyndham doing it gave me what my grandpa used to call the shivering hits. You know how gormy she is, Andy. All the Wyndhams are gormy, of course, but she's got the rest of them beat 7 ways to downtown. It's like she grows bumps right out of her body to knock things over with when she goes by them. It ain't her fault. It's just something in the blood. But I couldn't bear thinking of Shauna charging around in the parlor with all of Vera's carnival glass and Tiffany just begging to be knocked over. Still, I had to do something. Fool me twice, shame on me. And luckily, there was Susie to fall back on. She wasn't no ballerina, but it was her vacuumed the Orbison for the next year, and she never broke a thing. She's a good girl, Frank. And I can't tell you how glad I was to get that wedding announcement from her, even if the fella was from away. How are they doing? What do you hear? Well, that's fine. Fine, I'm glad for her. I don't suppose she's got a bun in the oven yet, does she? These days it seems like folks wait until they're almost ready for the old folks' home before they... Yes, Andy, I will. I just wish you'd remember it's my life I'm talking about here. My goddamn life. So why don't you just flop back in that big old chair of yours and put your feet up and relax? If you keep pushing that way, you're going to give yourself a rupture. Anyway, Frank, you give her my best and tell her she just about saved Dolores Claiborne's life in the summer of 91. You can give her the inside story about the Thursday shitstorms and how I stopped them. I never told them exactly what was going on. All they knew for sure was that I was butting heads with Her Royal Majesty. I see now I was ashamed to tell them what was going on. I guess I don't like getting beat any more than Vera ever did. It was the sound of the vacuum, you see. That was what I realized when I woke up that morning. I told you there was nothing wrong with her ears. It was the sound of the vacuum that told her if I was really doing the parlor or standing at the foot of the stairs on my mark. When a vacuum cleaner is sitting in one spot, it only makes one sound, you see. Just zoo, like that. But when you vacuum in a rug, it makes 2 sounds, and they go up and down in waves. Whoop, that's when you push it out, and zoop, when you pull it back to you for another stroke. Whoop, zoop, whoop, zoop, whoop, zoop. Quit scratching your head, you two, and look at the smile Nancy's wearing. All a body'd have to do to know which of you has spent some time running a vacuum cleaner is to look at your faces. If you really feel like it's that important, Andy, try it for yourself. You'll hear it right off. Though I imagine Maria'd just about drop dead if she came in and saw you vacuum in the living room rug. What I realized that morning was that she'd stopped just listening for when the vacuum cleaner started running because she'd realized that wasn't good enough anymore. She was listening to see if the sound went up and down like it does when a vacuum's actually working. She wouldn't pull her dirty little trick until she'd heard that whoop, zoop, wave. I was crazy to try out my new idea, but I couldn't right away because she went into one of her bad times right about then, and for quite a while she just did her business in the bedpan or peed a little in her diapers if she had to. And I started to get scared that this would be the time she wouldn't come back out of it. I know that sounds funny, since she was so much easier to mind when she was confused in her thinking. But when a person gets a good idea like that, they kind of want to take it for a test drive. And you know, I felt something for that bitch besides wanting to throttle her. After knowing her for over 40 years, it'd be goddamn strange if I didn't. She knitted me an afghan once, you know. This was long before she got really bad, but it's still on my bed. And it's some warm on those February nights when the wind plays up nasty. Then about a month or a month and a half after I woke up with my idea, she started to come round again. She'd watch Jeopardy on the little bedroom TV and rag the contestants if they didn't know who was president during the Spanish-American War or who played Melanie in Gone with the Wind. She started all her old globber about how her kids might come and visit her before Labor Day, and of course she pestered to be put in her chair so she could watch me hang the sheets and make sure I use 6 pins and not just 4. Then there come a Thursday when I pulled the bedpan out from under her at noon, dry as a bone and empty as a salesman's promises. I can't tell you how pleased I was to see that empty bedpan. Here we go, you sly old fox, I thought. Now ain't we gonna see? I went downstairs and called Susie Prue into the parlor. I want you to vacuum in here today, Susie, I told her. Okay, Mrs. Claiborne, she said. That's what both of them called me, Andy. What most people on the island call me, as far as that goes. I never made an issue of it at church or anywhere else, but that's how it is. It's like they think I was married to a fellow named Claiborne at some point in my checkered past. Or maybe I just want to believe most of them don't remember Joe, although I guess there's plenty who do. It don't matter too much one way or the other in the end. I guess I am entitled to believe what I want to believe. I was the one married to the bastard, after all.
I don't mind, she goes on, but why are you whispering?
Never mind, I said. Just keep your own voice down, and don't you break anything in here, Susan Emma Prue, don't you dare. Well, she blushed just as red as the side of the volunteer fire truck. It was actually sort of comical.
How did you know my middle name was Emma?
None of your beeswax, I says. I've spent donkey's years on Little Tall, and there's no end to the things I know, and the people I know 'em about. You just be careful of your elbows around the furniture and Mrs. God's carnival glass vases, especially when you're backing up, and you won't have a thing to worry about.
I'll be extra careful, she said.
I turned the Kirby on for her, and then I stepped into the hall, cupped my hands around my mouth, and hollered, Susie, Shauna, I'm gonna vacuum the parlor now. Susie was standing right there, of course, and I tell you that girl's entire face was a question mark. I just kind of flapped my hand at her, telling her to go on about her business and never mind me, which she did. I tiptoed over to the foot of the stairs and stood in my old place. I know it's silly, but I ain't been so excited since my dad took me hunting for the first time when I was 12. It was the same kind of feeling, too, with your heart beating hard and kind of flat in your chest and neck. The woman had dozens of valuable antiques as well as all that expensive glass in the parlor, but I never spared a thought to Susie Prue in there, whirling and twirling amongst them like a dervish, do you believe it? I made myself stay where I was as long as I could, about a minute and a half, I think. Then I dashed. And when I popped into her room, there she was, face red, eyes all squinched down into slits, fists balled up, going, Her eyes flew open in a hurry when she heard the bedroom door bang open, though. Oh, I wish I'd had a camera. It was priceless.
Dolores, you get right back out of here, she kind of squeaks. I'm trying to have a nap, and I can't do it if you're going to come busting in here like a bull with a hat on every 20 minutes.
Well, I said, I'll go, but first I think I'll put this old fanny pan under you. From the smell, I'd say a little scare was about all you needed to take care of your constipation problem. She slapped at my hands and cussed me. She could cuss something fierce when she wanted to. And she wanted to every time somebody crossed her. But I didn't pay much attention. I got the bedpan under as slick as a whistle, and like they say, everything came out all right. When it was done, I looked at her, and she looked at me, and neither one of us had to say a thing. We knew each other of old, you see. There, you nasty old Quim, I was saying with my face. I've caught up with you again, and how do you like it? Not much, Dolores, she was saying with hers, but that's all right. Just because you got caught up doesn't mean you'll stay caught up. I did, though. That time I did. There were a few more little messes, but never again anything like the time I told you about, when there was even shit on the curtains. That was really her last hurrah. After that, the times when her mind was clear got fewer and fewer, and when they came, they were short. It saved my aching back. But it made me sad, too. She was a pain, but it was one I'd gotten used to. I knew it for what it was when it came, and didn't go off half-cocked thinking it was cancer or a heart attack, if you see what I mean. Could I have another glass of water, Frank? Thank you. Talking's thirsty work. And if you decide to let that bottle of Gentleman Jim Beam out of your desk for a little fresh air, Andy, I'll never tell. No? Well, that's about what I expected from the likes of you. Now, where was I? Oh, I know, about how she was. Well, the third way she had of being a bitch was the worst. She was a bitch because she was a sad old lady who had nothing to do but die in an upstairs bedroom on an island far from the places and the people she'd known most of her life. That was bad enough, but she was losing her mind while she did it. And there was part of her that knew the rest of her was like an undercut riverbank getting ready to slide down into the stream. She was lonely, you see, and that I didn't understand. I never understood why she threw over her whole life to come out to the island in the first place, at least not until yesterday. But she was scared, too, and I could understand that just fine. And even so, she had a horrible, scary kind of strength, like a dying queen that won't let go of her crown even at the end. It's like God himself has got to pry it loose a finger at a time. She had her good days and her bad ones, I told you that. What I call her fits always happened in between, when she was changing from a few days of being bright to a week or two of being fogged in, or from a week or two of being fogged in to a time of being bright again. When she was changing, it was like she was nowhere, and part of her knew that, too. That was the time when she'd have her hallucinations. If they were all hallucinations. I'm not so sure about that as I used to be. Maybe I'll tell you that part, and maybe I won't. I'll just have to see how I feel when the time comes. I guess they didn't all come on Sunday afternoons or in the middle of the night. I guess it's just that I remember those ones the best because the house was so quiet, and it would scare me so when she started screaming. It was like having somebody throw a bucket of ice-cold water over you on a hot summer's day. There never was a time I didn't think my heart would stop when her screams began. And there never was a time I didn't think I'd come into her room and find her dying. The things she was scared of never made sense, though. I mean, I knew she was scared, and I had a pretty good idea what she was scared of, but never why. "The wires!" she'd be screaming sometimes when I went in. She'd be all scrunched up in bed, her hands clutched together between her boobs, her punky old mouth drawn up and trembling. She'd be as pale as a ghost, and the tears would be running down the wrinkles under her eyes. "The wires, Dolores, stop the wires!" and she'd always point at the same place, the baseboard in the far corner. Wasn't nothing there, of course, except there was to her. She seen all these wires coming out of the wall and scratching across the floor toward her bed. At least that's what I think she seen. What I'd do was run downstairs and get one of the butcher knives off the kitchen rack and then come back up with it. I'd kneel down in the corner, or closer to the bed if she acted like they'd already progressed a fairish way, and pretend to chop them off. I'd do that, bringing the blade down light and easy on the floor so I wouldn't scar that good maple, until she stopped crying. Then I'd go over to her and wipe the tears off her face with my apron or one of the Kleenex she always kept stuffed under a pillow, and I'd kiss her a time or two and say, "There, dear, they're gone. I chopped off every one of those pesky wires, see for yourself." She'd look, although at these times I'm telling you about she couldn't really see nothing. And she'd cry some more like as not, and then she'd hug me and say, "Thank you, Dolores, I thought this time they were gonna get me for sure." Or sometimes she'd call me Brenda when she thanked me. She was the housekeeper the Donovans had in their Baltimore place. Other times she'd call me Clarice, who was her sister and died in 1958. Sometimes I'd get up there to her room and she'd be half off the bed, screaming that there was a snake inside her pillow. Other times she'd be setting up with the blankets over her head, hollering that the windows were magnifying the sun and it was going to burn her up. Sometimes she'd swear she could already feel her hair frizzing. Didn't matter if it was raining or foggier than a drunk's head outside, she was bound and determined the sun was going to fry her alive, so I'd pull down all the shades and then hold her until she stopped crying. Sometimes I held her longer, because even after she'd gotten quiet, I could feel her trembling like a puppy that's been mistreated by mean kids. She'd ask me over and over again to look at her skin and tell her if it had blistered anywhere. I'd tell her over and over again that it hadn't. And after a little of that, she'd sometimes go to sleep. Other times, she wouldn't. She'd just fall into a stupor, muttering to people who weren't there. Sometimes she'd talk French. And I don't mean that parlez-vous island French either. She and her husband loved Paris and went there every chance they got, sometimes with the kids and sometimes by themselves. Sometimes she talked about it when she was feeling perky. The cafes, the nightclubs, the galleries, and the boats on the Seine. And I loved to listen. She had a way with words, Vera did. And when she really talked a thing up, you could almost see it. But the worst thing, what she was scared of most of all, were nothing but dust bunnies. You know what I mean? Those little balls of dust that collect under beds and behind doors and in corners. Look sort of like milkweed pods, they do. I knew it was them even when she couldn't say it, and most times I could get her calmed down again. But why she was so scared of a bunch of ghost turds, what she really thought they were, that I don't know. Although I once got an idea. Don't laugh, but it come to me in a dream. Luckily, the business of the dust bunnies didn't come up so often as the sun burning her skin or the wires in the corner. But when that was it, I knew I was in for a bad time. I knew it was dust bunnies, even if it was the middle of the night and I was in my room fast asleep with the door closed when she started screaming. When she got a bee in her bonnet about the other things. What, honey? Oh, wasn't I? No, you don't need to move your cute little recorder any closer. If you want me to talk up, I will. Most generally, I'm the ballinest bitch you ever run across. Joe used to say he wished for cotton to stick in his ears every time I was in the house. But the way she was about the dust bunnies gave me the creeps. And if my voice dropped, I guess that just proves they still do. Even with her dead, they still do. Sometimes I used to scold her about it. "Why do you want to get up to such a mess of foolishness, Vera?" I'd say. But it wasn't foolishness. Not to Vera, at least. I thought more than once that I knew how she'd finally punch out. She'd scare herself to death over those friggin' dust bunnies. And that ain't so far from the truth, either. now that I think about it. What I started to say was that when she got a bee in her bonnet about the other things, the snake in the pillow slip, the sun, the wires, she'd scream. When it was the dust bunnies, she'd shriek. Wasn't even words in it most times, just shrieking so long and loud it put ice cubes in your heart. I'd run in there and she'd be yanking at her hair or harrowing her face with her fingernails and looking like a witch. Her eyes would be so big they almost looked like soft-boiled eggs, and they were always staring into one corner or the other. Sometimes she was able to say, "Dust bunnies, Dolores! Oh, my God, dust bunnies!" Other times she could only cry and gag. She'd clap her hands over her eyes for a second or two, but then she'd take them back down. It was like she couldn't bear to look, but couldn't bear not to look either. And she'd start going at her face with her fingernails again. I kept them clipped, just as short as I could, but she still drew blood lots of times. And I wondered every time it happened how her heart could stand the plain terror of it, as old and fat as she was. One time she fell right out of bed and just lay there with one leg twisted under her. Scared the bejesus out of me, it did. I ran in and there she was on the floor, beating her fists on the boards like a kid doing a tantrum and screaming fit to raise the roof. That was the only time in all the years I did for her that I called Dr. Freneau in the middle of the night. He came over from Jonesport in Collie Violet's speedboat. I called him because I thought her leg was broken. Had to be, the way it was bent under her, and she'd almost surely die of the shock. But it wasn't. I don't know how it wasn't, but Freneau said it was just sprained. And the next day she slipped into one of her bright periods again and didn't remember a thing of it. I asked her about the dust bunnies a couple of times when she had the world more or less in focus, and she looked at me like I was crazy. Didn't have the slightest idea what I was talking about. After it happened a few times, I knew what to do. As soon as I heard her shrieking that way, I was up from bed and out my door. My bedroom's only two doors down from hers, you know, with the linen closet in between. I kept a broom propped in the hall with the dustpan poked onto the end of the handle ever since she had her first hissy over the dust bunnies. I'd go pelting into her room, waving the broom like I was trying to flag down a goddamn mail train, screaming myself. It was the only way I could make myself heard. "I'll get 'em, Vera," I'd shout. "I'll get 'em. Just hold the friggin' phone." And I'd sweep at whatever corner she was staring into, and then I'd do the other one for good measure. Sometimes she'd calm down after that, but more often she'd start hollering that there were more under the bed. So I'd get down on my hands and knees and make like I was sweeping under there, too. Once the stupid, scared, pitiful old dub almost fell right out of bed on top of me, trying to lean over and look for herself. She probably would have squashed me like a fly. What a comedy that would have been. Once I'd swept every place that had her scared, I'd show her my empty dustpan and say, "There, dear, see? I got every one of those prickish things." She'd look into the dustpan first. Then she'd look up at me, trembling all over, her eyes so drowned in her own tears that they swam like rocks when you look down and see them in a stream. And she'd whisper, "Oh, Dolores, they're so gray, so nasty. Take them away, please, take them away." I'd put the broom and the empty dustpan back outside my door, handy for action next time, and then I'd go back in to soothe her as best I could, to soothe myself as well. And if you think I didn't need a little soothing, you try waking up all alone in a big old museum like that in the middle of the night, with the wind screaming outside and an old crazy woman screaming inside. My heart'd be going like a locomotive, and I couldn't hardly get my breath. But I couldn't let her see how I was, or she'd have started to doubt me. And wherever would we have gone from there? What I'd do most times after those set-tos was brush her hair. It was the thing that seemed to calm her down the quickest. She'd moan and cry at first, and sometimes she'd reach out her arms and hug me, pushing her face against my belly. I remember how hot her cheeks and forehead always were after she threw one of her dust bunny wingdings, and how sometimes she'd wet my nightie right through with her tears. Poor old woman. I don't guess any of us here know what it is to be that old, and to have devils after you you can't explain even to yourself. Sometimes not even half an hour with the hairbrush would do the trick. She'd keep looking past me into the corner, and every so often she'd catch her breath and whimper. Or she'd flap her hand at the dark under the bed and then kind of snatch it back, like she expected something under there to try and bite it. Once or twice, even I thought I saw something moving under there, and I had to clamp my mouth shut to keep from screaming myself. All I saw was just the moving shadow of her own hand, of course, I know that, but it shows what a state she got me in, don't it? Yeah, even me. And I'm usually just as hard-headed as I am loud-mouthed. On those times when nothing else would do, I'd get into bed with her. Her arms would creep around me and hold onto my sides, and she'd lay the side of her head down on what's left of my bosom, and I'd put my arms around her and just hold her until she drifted off. Then I'd creep out of bed, real slow and easy, so as not to wake her up, and go back to my own room. There was a few times I didn't even do that. Those times, they always came when she woke me up in the middle of the night with her yowling. I fell asleep with her. It was on one of those nights that I dreamed about the dust bunnies. Only in the dream, I wasn't me. I was her, stuck in that hospital bed, so fat I couldn't even hardly turn over without help, and my coos burning way down deep from the urinary infection that wouldn't never really go away on account of how she was always damp down there and had no real resistance to anything. The welcome mat was out for any bug or germ that came along, you might say, and it was always turned around the right way. I looked over in the corner, and what I saw was this thing that looked like a head made out of dust. Its eyes were all rolled up, and its mouth was open and full of long, snaggly dust teeth. It started coming toward the bed, but slow. And when it rolled around to the face side again, the eyes were looking right at me. And I saw it was Michael Donovan, Vera's husband. The second time the face come around, though, it was my husband. It was Joe St. George, with a mean grin on his face and a lot of long dust teeth, all snapping. The third time it rolled around, it wasn't nobody I knew, but it was alive. It was hungry, and it meant to roll all the way over to where I was so it could eat me. I woke myself up with such a god-awful jerk that I almost fell out of bed myself. It was early morning with the first sun laying across the floor in a stripe. Vera was still sleeping. She drooled all over my arm, but at first I didn't have the strength to wipe it off. I just laid there trembling, all covered with sweat, trying to make myself believe I was really awake and things was really all right, the way you do, you know, after a really bad nightmare. And for a second there, I could still see that dust head, with its big, empty eyes and long, dusty teeth, laying on the floor beside the bed. That's how bad the dream was. Then it was gone. The floor and the corners of the room were as clean and empty as always. But I've always wondered since then if maybe she didn't send me that dream. If I didn't see a little of what she saw those times when she screamed. Maybe I picked up a little of her fear and made it my own. You think things like that ever happen in real life? Or only in those cheap newspapers they sell down to the grocery? I don't know. But I know that dream scared the bejesus out of me. Well, never mind. Suffice it to say that screaming her friggin' head off on Sunday afternoons and in the middle of the night was the third way she had of being a bitch. But it was a sad, sad thing all the same. All her bitchiness was sad at the bottom, although that didn't stop me from sometimes wanting to spin her head around like a spool on a spindle and I think anybody but Saint Joan of friggin' Art would have felt the same. I guess when Susie and Shauna heard me yelling that day that I'd like to kill her, or when other people heard me, or heard us yelling mean things at each other, well, they must have thought I'd hike up my skirts and tap dance on her grave when she finally give over. And I imagine you've heard from some of them yesterday and today, haven't you, Andy? No need to answer. All the answer I need's right there on your face. It's a regular billboard. Besides, I know how people love to talk. They talked about me and Vera, and there was a country fair amount of globber about me and Joe, too. Some before he died and even more after. Out here in the boondocks, about the most interesting thing a person can do is die sudden. Did you ever notice that? So here we are at Joe. I've been dreading this part, and I guess there's no use lying about it. I already told you I killed him, so that's over with. But the hard part is still all ahead. How and why and when it had to be. I've been thinking about Joe a lot today, Andy. More about him than about Vera, truth to tell. I kept trying to remember just why I married him in the first place, for one thing. And at first I couldn't do it. After a while, I got into a kind of panic about it, like Vera when she'd get the idea there was a snake inside her pillow slip. Then I realized what the trouble was. I was looking for the love part, like I was one of those foolish little girls Vera used to hire in June and then fire before the summer was halfway done because they couldn't keep to her rules. I was looking for the love part, and there was precious little of that even back in 1945, when I was 18 and he was 19 and the world was new. You know, the only thing that come to me while I was out there on the steps today, freezing my tuchus off and trying to remember about the love part? He had a nice forehead. I sat near him in study hall back when we was in high school together, during World War II, that was, and I remember his forehead, how smooth it looked, without a single pimple on it. There was some on his cheeks and chin, and he was prone to blackheads on the sides of his nose, but his forehead looked as smooth as cream. I remember wanting to touch it, dreaming about touching it, to tell the truth, wanting to see if it was as smooth as it looked. And when he asked me for the junior-senior prom, I said yes, and I got my chance to touch his forehead, and it was every bit as smooth as it looked, with his hair going back from it in these nice smooth waves. Me stroking his hair and his smooth forehead in the dark while the band inside the ballroom of the Samoset Inn played Moonlight Cocktail. After a few hours of sitting on those damn rickety steps and shivering, that came back to me at least. So you see, there was a little something there after all. Of course, I found myself touching a lot more than just his forehead before too many more weeks had passed, and that was where I made my mistake. Now let's get one thing straight. I ain't trying to say I ended up spending the best years of my life with that old rumpot just because I liked the look of his forehead in period 7 study hall when the light came slanting in on it. Shit, no. But I am trying to tell you that's all the love part I was able to remember today. And that makes me feel bad. Sitting out on the stairs today by the east head, thinking over those old times. That was damned hard work. It was the first time I saw that I might have sold myself cheap. And maybe I did it because I thought cheap was the best the likes of me could expect to get for herself. I know it was the first time I dared to think that I deserved to be loved more'n Joe St. George could love anybody, except himself, maybe. You mightn't think a hard-talking old bitch like me believes in love, but the truth is, it's just about the only thing I do believe in. It didn't have much to do with why I married him, though. I gotta tell you that straight out. I had 6 weeks' worth of baby girl in my belly when I told him I didn't, I would, until death do us part. And that was the smartest part of it, sad but true. The rest of it was all the usual stupid reasons. And one thing I've learned in my life is that stupid reasons make stupid marriages. I was tired of fighting with my mother. I was tired of being scolded by my father. All my friends was doing it. They was getting homes of their own, and I wanted to be a grown-up like them. I was tired of being a silly little girl. He said he wanted me, and I believed him. He said he loved me, and I believed that, too. And after he'd said it and asked me if I felt the same for him, It only seemed polite to say I did. I was scared of what would happen to me if I didn't, where I'd have to go, what I'd have to do, who'd look after my baby while I was doing it. All that's going to look pretty silly if you ever write it up, Nancy. But the silliest thing is I know a dozen women who were girls I went to school with who got married for those same reasons. And most of them are still married, and a good many of them are only holding on, hoping to outlive the old man so they can bury him and then shake his beer farts out of the sheets forever. By 1952 or so, I'd pretty well forgotten his forehead. And by 1956, I didn't have much use for the rest of him either. And I guess I'd started hating him by the time Kennedy took over from Ike. But I never had a thought of killing him till later. I thought I'd stay with him because my kids needed a father, if for no other reason. Ain't that a laugh? But it's the truth, I swear it is. And I swear something else as well. If God gave me a second chance, I'd kill him again. Even if it meant hellfire and damnation forever. Which it probably does. I guess everybody on Little Tall who ain't a Johnny come lately knows I killed him. And most of them probably think they know why, because of the way he had of using his hands on me. But it wasn't his hands on me that brought him to grief. And the simple truth is that no matter what people on the island might have thought at the time, he never hit me a single lick during the last 3 years of our marriage. I cured him of that foolishness in late 1960 or early 61. Up until then, he hit me quite a lot, yes. I can't deny it. And I stood for it. I can't deny that either. The first time was the second night of the marriage. We'd gone down to Boston for the weekend. That was our honeymoon. And stayed at the Parker House. Hardly went out the whole time. We was just a couple of country mice, you know, and afraid we'd get lost. Joe said he was damned if he was going to spend the $25 my folks had given us for mad money on a taxi ride just because he couldn't find his way back to the hotel. Gory, weren't that man dumb? Of course I was, too. But one thing Joe had that I didn't, and I'm glad of it, too, was that everlasting suspicious nature of his. He had the idea the whole human race was out to do him dirty, Joe did. And I thought plenty of times that when he did get drunk, maybe it was because it was the only way he could go to sleep without leaving one eye open. Well, that ain't neither here nor there. What I set out to tell you was that we went down to the dining room that Saturday night, had a good dinner, and then went back up to our room again. Joe was listening considerably to starboard on the walk down the hall, I remember. He'd had 4 or 5 beers with his dinner and another 9 or 10 over the course of the afternoon. Once we were inside the room, he stood there looking at me so long I asked him if he saw anything green. No, he says, but I seen a man down there in that restaurant looking up your dress, Dolores. His eyes were just about hanging out on springs, and you knew he was looking, didn't you? I almost told him Gary Cooper could have been sitting in the corner with Rita Hayworth, and I wouldn't have known it. And then thought, why bother? It didn't do any good to argue with Joe when he'd been drinking. I didn't go into that marriage with my eyes entirely shut, and I'm not going to try to kid you that I did. If there was a man looking up my dress, why didn't you go over and tell him to shut his eyes, Joe? I asked. It was only a joke. Maybe I was trying to turn him aside. I really don't remember. But he didn't take it as a joke. That I do remember. Joe wasn't a man to take a joke. In fact, I'd have to say he had almost no sense of humor at all. That was something I didn't know going into it with him. I thought back then that a sense of humor was like a nose or a pair of ears, that some worked better than others, but everybody had one. He grabbed me and turned me over his knee and paddled me with his shoe. For the rest of your life, nobody's going to have any idea what color underwear you got on but me, Dolores, he said. You hear that? Nobody but me. I actually thought it was a kind of love play, him pretending to be jealous, to flatter me. That's what a little ninny I was. It was jealousy, all right, but love had nothing to do with it. It was more like the way a dog will put a paw over his bone and growl if you come too near it. I didn't know that then, so I put up with it. Later on, I put up with it because I thought a man hitting his wife from time to time was only another part of being married. Not a nice part, but then cleaning toilets ain't a nice part of being married either. But most women have done their fair share of it after the bridal dress and veil have been packed away in the attic. Ain't they, Nancy? My own dad used his hands on my mum from time to time. And I suppose that was where I got the idea that it was all right. Just something to be put up with. I loved my dad dearly, and him and her loved each other dearly. But he could be a handsy kind of man when he had a hair laying just right across his ass. I remember one time, I must have been, I'm going to say 9 years old, when Dad came in from hay in George Richard's field over on the West End, and Mum didn't have his dinner on. I can't remember any more why she didn't, but I remember real well what happened when he came in. He was wearing only his bibballs. He'd taken his work boots and socks off out on the stoop because they were full of chaff, and his face and shoulders was burned bright red. His hair was sweated against his temples, and there was a piece of hay stuck to his forehead right in the middle of the lines that waved across his brow. He looked hot and tired and ready to be pissed off. He went into the kitchen, and there wasn't nothing on the table but a glass pitcher with flowers in it. He turns to Mum and says, "Where's my supper, dummy?" She opened her mouth, but before she could say anything, he put his hand over her face and pushed her down in the corner. I was standing in the kitchen entry and seen it all. He come walking toward me with his head lowered and his hair kind of hanging in his eyes. Whenever I see a man walking home that way, tired out from his day of work and his dinner bucket in his hand, it makes me think of my dad. And I was some scared. I wanted to get out of his way because I felt he would push me down too. But my legs was too heavy to move. He never, though. He just took hold of me with his big, warm, hard hands and set me aside and went out back. He sat down on the chopping block with his hands in his lap and his head hung down like he was looking at them. He scared the chickens away at first, but they come back after a while and started pecking all around his shoes. I thought he'd kick out at them, make the feathers fly, but he never done that either. After a while, I looked around at my mum. She was still sitting in the corner. She'd put a dish towel over her face and was crying underneath it. Her arms were crossed over her bosom. That's what I remember best of all, though I don't know why, how her arms were crossed over her bosom like that. I went over and hugged her, and she felt her arms around my middle and hugged me back. Then she took the dish towel off her face and used it to wipe her eyes and told me to go out back and ask Daddy if he wanted a glass of cold lemonade or a bottle of beer. "Be sure to tell him there's only 2 bottles of beer," she said. "If he wants more than that, he'd better go to the store or not get started at all." I went out and told him, and he said he didn't want no beer, but a glass of lemonade would hit the spot. I ran to fetch it. Mum was getting his supper. Her face was still kind of swole from crying, but she was humming a tune. And that night they bounced the bed springs just like they did most nights. Nothing else was ever said or made of it. That sort of thing was called home correction in those days. It was part of a man's job. And if I thought of it afterward at all, I only thought that my mum must have needed some, or Dad never would have done what he did. There was a few other times I saw him correct her, but that's the one I remember best. I never saw him hit her with his fist, like Joe sometimes hit me. But once he stropped her across the legs with a piece of wet canvas sailcloth, and that must have hurt like a bastard. I know it left red marks that didn't go away all afternoon. No one calls it home correction anymore. The term has passed right out of conversation, so far as I can tell, and good riddance. But I grew up with the idea that when women and children step off the straight and narrow, it's a man's job to herd them back onto it. I ain't trying to tell you that just because I grew up with the idea, I thought it was right, though. I won't let myself slip off that easy. I knew that a man using his hands on a woman didn't have much to do with correction. But I let Joe go on doing it to me for a long time just the same. I guess I was just too tired from keeping house, cleaning for the summer people, raising my family, and trying to clean up Joe's messes with the neighbors to think much about it. Being married to Joe, oh, shit, what's any marriage like? I guess they are all different ways, but There ain't one of them that's what it looks like from the outside, I can tell you that. What people see of a married life and what actually goes on inside it are usually not much more than kissing cousins. Sometimes that's awful, and sometimes it's funny. But usually it's like all the other parts of life, both things at the same time. What people think is that Joe was an alcoholic who used to beat me, and probably the kids too, when he was drunk. They think he finally did it once too often and I punched his ticket for it. It's true that Joe drank, and that he sometimes went to the AA meetings over in Jonesport, but he was no more an alcoholic than I am. He'd throw a drunk every 4 or 5 months, mostly with trash like Jerry Thibodeau or Stevie Brooks. Those men really were alcoholics. But then he'd leave it alone except for a nip or two when he came in at night. No more than that, because when he had a bottle, he liked to make it last. The real alkies I've known in my time, none of them was interested in making a bottle of anything last. Not Jim Beam or Old Duke, not even DeRail, which is antifreeze strained through cotton batten. A real drunk is only interested in two things, putting paid to the jug in the hand and hunting for the one still in the bush. No, he wasn't an alcoholic, but he didn't mind if people thought he'd been one. It helped him get work, especially in the summer. I guess the way people think about Alcoholics Anonymous has changed over the years. I know they talk about it a lot more than they used to. But one thing that hasn't changed is the way people will try to help somebody who claims he's already gone to work helping himself. Joe spent one whole year not drinking, or at least not talking about it when he did. And they had a party for him over in Jonesport. Gave him a cake and a medallion, they did. So when he went for a job one of the summer people needed done, the first thing he'd tell them was that he was a recovering alcoholic. If you don't want to hire me because of that, I won't have any hard feelings, he'd say. But I have to get it off my chest. I've been going to AA meetings for over a year now, and they tell us we can't stay sober if we can't be honest. And then he'd pull out his gold one-year medallion and show it to them, all the while looking like he hadn't had nothing to eat but humble pie for a month of Sundays. I guess one or two of them just about cried when Joe told him about how he was working it a day at a time and taking it easy and letting go and letting God whenever the urge for a drink hit him, which it did about every 15 minutes, according to him. They'd usually fall all over themselves taking him on, and at 50 cents or even a dollar an hour more than they'd intended to pay, like as not. You'd have thought the gimmick would have fallen flat after Labor Day, but it worked amazing well even here on the island, where people saw him every day and should have known better. The truth is, most of the times Joe hit me, he was cold sober. When he had his skin full, he didn't much mind me at all, one way or the other. Then in 60 or 61, he come in one night after helping Charlie Dispensieri get his boat out of the water. And when he bent over to get a Coke out of the fridge, I seen his britches were split right up the back. I laughed. I couldn't help myself. He didn't say nothing. But when I went over to the stove to check on the cabbage, I was making a boiled dinner that night, I remember like it was yesterday. He got a chunk of rock maple out of the wood box and whacked me in the small of the back with it. Oh, that hurt. You know what I mean if anyone's ever hit you in the kidneys? It makes them feel small and hot and so heavy, like they're going to bust loose from whatever holds them where they're supposed to be, and they'll just sink, like lead shot in a bucket. I hobbled as far as the table and sat in one of the chairs. I would have fallen on the floor if that chair had been any further away. I just sat there, waiting to see if the pain was going to pass. I didn't cry exactly because I didn't want to scare the kids, but the tears went rolling down my face just the same. I couldn't stop them. They were tears of pain, the kind you can't hold back for anybody or anything. "Don't you ever laugh at me, you bitch," Joe says. He slung the stove length he hit me with back into the wood box, then sat down to read the American. "You ought to have known better than that 10 years ago. It was 20 minutes before I could get out of that chair. I had to call Selena to turn down the heat under the veg and the meat, even though the stove wasn't but 4 steps away from where I was sitting. "Why didn't you do it, Mommy?" she asked me. I was watching cartoons with Joey. I'm resting, I told her. That's right, Joe says from behind his paper. She ran her mouth until she got all tuckered out, and he laughed. That did it. That one laugh was all it took. I decided right then he wasn't never going to hit me again, unless he wanted to pay a dear price for it. We had supper just like usual, and watched the TV just like usual afterward, me and the big kids on the sofa, and little Pete on his father's lap in the big easy chair. Pete dozed off there, same as he almost always did, around 7:30, and Joe carried him to bed. I sent Joan Jr. an hour later, and Selena went at 9. I usually turned in around 10, and Joe'd sit up until maybe midnight, dozing in and out, watching a little TV, reading parts of the paper he'd missed the first time, and picking his nose. So you see, Frank, you're not so bad. Some people never lose the habit, even when they grow up. That night, I didn't go to bed when I usually did. I sat up with Joe instead. My back felt a little better. Good enough to do what I had to do, anyway. Maybe I was nervous about it, but if I was, I don't recall. I was mostly waiting for him to doze off, and finally he did. I got up, went into the kitchen, and got the little cream pitcher off the table. I didn't go out looking for that special. It was only there because it was Joe Jr.'s night to clean off the table, and he'd forgotten to put it in the refrigerator. Joe Jr. always forgot something. To put away the cream pitcher, to put the glass top on the butter dish, to fold the bread wrapper under so the first slice wouldn't get all hard overnight. And now when I see him on the TV news, making a speech or giving an interview, that's what I'm most apt to think about. I wonder what the Democrats would think if they knew the majority leader of the Maine State Senate couldn't never manage to get the kitchen table completely cleared off when he was 11. I'm proud of him, though, and don't you ever, ever think any different. I'm proud of him, even if he is a goddamn Democrat. Anyway, he sure managed to forget the right thing that night. It was little, but it was heavy, and it felt just right in my hand. I went over to the wood box, and I got the short-handled hatchet we kept on the shelf just above it. Then I walked back into the living room where he was dozing. I had the pitcher cupped in my right hand, and I just brought it down and around and smacked it against the side of his face. It broke into about 1,000 pieces. He sat up pretty pert when I done that, Andy. And you should have heard him. Loud? Father God and Sonny Jesus. Sounded like a bull with his pizzle caught in the garden gate. His eyes come wide open and he clapped his hand to his ear, which was already bleeding. There was little dots of clotted cream on his cheek, and then that scraggle down the side of his face he called a sideburn. "Guess what, Joe," I says. "I ain't feeling tired anymore." I heard Selena jump out of bed, but I didn't dare look around. I could have been in hot water if I'd done that. When he wanted to, he could be sneaky fast. I'd been holding the hatchet in my left hand down to my side with my apron almost covering it. And when Joe started to get up out of his chair, I brought it out and showed it to him. "If you don't want this in your head, Joe, you better sit down again," I said. For a second, I thought he was going to get up anyway. If he had, that would have been the end of him right then, because I wasn't kidding. He seen it, too, and froze with his butt about 5 inches off the seat. "Mommy?" Selena called from the doorway of her room. "You go on back to bed, honey," I says, not taking my eyes off Joe for a single second. "Your father and I are having a little discussion here." "Is everything all right?" "Yeah," I says. "Isn't it, Joe?" "Uh-huh," he says, "right as rain." I heard her take a few steps back, but I didn't hear the door of her room close for a little while. 10, maybe 15 seconds. And I knew she was standing there and looking at us. Joe stayed just like he was, with one hand on the arm of his chair and his butt hiked up off of the seat. Then we heard her door close, and that seemed to make Joe realize how foolish he must look, half in his seat and half out of it, with his other hand clapped over his ear and little clots of cream dribbling down the side of his face. He sat all the way down and took his hand away. Both it and his ear were full of blood. But his hand wasn't swelling up, and his ear was. Oh, bitch, ain't you gonna get a payback, he says. Am I? I told him. Well, then you better remember this, Joe St. George. What you pay out to me, you are gonna get back done.